You're listening to Talking in Circles, a series of conversations with Caspian, produced in cooperation with Triple Crown Records. I'm Mike Moschetto. The release date of Caspian's fifth full-length studio album, On Circles, is January 24th. And last week, the band debuted the record's title track, Circles on Circles. You're hearing it now underneath me. Astute listeners will note that it not only eschews Caspian's characteristic heavily layered wall of sound, but also features beautiful, plaintive lead vocals from band leader and guitarist Phil Jamieson. In this episode, we talked about the band's increasing, let's call it flirtatiousness, over their last few records with utilizing lead vocals like the song Run Dry from 2015's Dust and Disquiet, and, more germane to this podcast series, their collaboration with Kyle Durfee from Piano's Become the Teeth, that's on a track from On Circles by the name of Nostalgist. We also chat about how the band cultivated such a global audience, what it even means to play post-rock anymore in 2020, and we describe our favorite ways to take in new music for the first time. Speaking of which, the official listening party for On Circles will be held tomorrow night, Thursday, January 16th, at the Charles Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Science in Boston. It's probably sold out already at this point, but still, I gotta mention it, it's pretty cool. Anyway, this is episode 2 of the series. You would do well to go back to episode 1 and check that out if you haven't heard it yet. But it's a free country, so I guess do whatever. Without further ado, here's part 2 of Talking in Circles, Conversations with Caspian. So according to your Wikipedia page, you played your first few gigs before you landed on a name and before you landed on a vocalist, it says?
Yeah.
So the search continues then, huh?
Yeah, continue. Yeah.
We actually got our first vocalist to join the band.
He's sitting right next to me.
It's Aaron.
It's funny.
The quiet one?
Yeah.
No way.
We weren't dogmatically looking for a vocalist, and we weren't dogmatically like claiming that we were just going to be instrumental. We were trying to let the process materialize as naturally as it could, and that included whether or not to have a singer. So we did play our first show without one, and I do remember saying, come check us out next month at Dodge Street or whatever, one of those old North Shore haunts. We're going to have a vocalist then and whatever, and everyone after the show was like, y'all don't need one of those,
man. Technically, our second show was at TT's. We played with Mono.
Your second show was with Mono?
Yeah. We just somehow, Phil got us on the bill.
Yeah, that was September of 2004. And we had tickets to see them, and Fly Pan Am was opening for them. I don't know if you've heard of Fly Pan Am,
but
old Constellation band who I was a big fan of. And that's when news was being disseminated on people's, you know, websites. There was no social media then.
Message boards and
MySpace
stuff.
Wasn't even really a thing, or maybe it was, but whatever. I heard that the drummer fell off a ladder serendipitously. And
thank God, you know?
Yeah, he was fine. But
I heard some really tall guy pushed him off a ladder. Crazy.
I got wind a couple days before that show that they had to cancel their dates. So I hit up the owner of TT the Bears, who was Randy Millman, who I think is still doing stuff in Boston, and said, look, our band is ready to play this gig. We'll do it for free. We'll bring 100 people guaranteed. We'll blow it up. And she kind of laughed and snickered a little. And I was like, oh, I'm serious. Let's go for it. So I think we ended up bringing like 150 people.
Yeah, we showed up. It's good.
We had a great time. You know, Mono at that time was, you know, they were on their upward trajectory. They weren't obviously where they're at now. But they were really exciting. They still are. They were a really exciting band for us at that point. It was cool because, you know, if, you know, we look back on this, we were just kind of lucky to be in the right place at the right time with a lot of, there's a lot of bands out there, especially now and especially in this genre, who are working really hard, who are significantly better and more talented than we were when we were starting out, and probably in a lot of cases better than we are now.
Don't say that.
But
this is your podcast.
Well, it's hard though, because, you know, we were sort of at the, this, well, I don't want to get into like a, you know, the whole backstory of this genre and the history of it, because I would just pontificate forever.
Well, I mean, suffice to say that bands starting now kind of had more source material to work with,
sure.
I think you're absolutely kind of blazing a trail in many ways.
There was a second wave of this that started happening around 2002-ish. The torch runners of that were like Explosions, Mono. There was Maserati sort of like on another tier. And then we were way at the bottom, but, you know, there were just less fish in the sea.
Sure.
So, we sort of capitalized on that with that Boston show, and then we sort of established a relationship with Randy at TT's, and I think we played there like 23 times and just, you know, kept blowing it out and really sort of cut our chops live at that venue at the Middle East. And also, speaking of timing, you know, we were just right fresh out of college. So we had a huge circle of friends that still wanted to go out and hang out and drink beers and go to shows, and there wasn't like people loafing around on the couch, like watching Netflix or something. Like there was a really like vibrant social atmosphere.
Netflix
and we kind of
didn't exist then.
Yeah. Well, nothing like that really existed then. People were still sort of, well, they were much more pro-social. So we benefited from that as well. You know, a lot of these bands that are out now, it's tough, man. It's hard to get people out to your show, especially on a Tuesday night at 10:30 PM when there's just so many other options readily available to you that don't involve leaving the house. So we were lucky to be right at the cusp of that point where that you could see that sort of coming down the pipeline, but it hadn't really made its way there yet. So it was almost like the twilight of people going out and spending time together and really going to shows. I know people go to shows now, of course, but it
no,
just,
I know
it
exactly
just,
what you mean.
You know
I
what
mean,
I'm saying? It just seemed really different back then, and we were really lucky to be right at the edge of that, I think.
Is that something you've kind of monitored over time? Is it still harder to get people out to shows now? Are you kind of fighting against more distraction, I guess?
The only way to actually make a living playing music is to be on tour. So a bigger thing now is just that everyone's on tour at the same time. We had one show we played in Berlin where Godspeed was playing across town, and it's like, wow. Not only is it another band in the genre, but it's arguably the best band in the genre. But, you know, they're all trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Whether they like to admit that they make money when they go on tour or not.
you split it between 13 people. It's a little harder.
It's a co-op. It's a leaderless resistance. I want to get back to the vocals because it's significant. You introduced this on the last record, that beautiful song that you sang, Cal.
Thank you. Aaron also did some singing on that record.
It's kind of crazy. I actually didn't know that Aaron was supposed to be the singer.
Yeah, that was all
breaking
of,
news.
We were just, I was in another band at the same time, and we were all just
friends.
Making music and whatever, and I sat in a few practices. And
what was the name of the band?
Viagra Sky. No, it's Flyagra Sky. Although we got called Viagra Sky more often.
Fly.
Yeah. It's like, I don't even want to explain what the name means. It's so dumb.
But they were part of the family, though, so it was a little incestuous in the early days. Some people were playing guitar here and there. Some people were like, let's see what you singing over this song sounds like. And you know, the whole thing, Aaron being a singer was like, had a shelf life of like 3 weeks or something.
So was it an easy decision to start writing songs with vocals and lyrics, or was it something you were laboring over for a while before you actually pulled the trigger?
Well, we started incorporating vocals. Like, I mean, there's vocal textures going back to Tertia.
Well, sure.
And then,
but out in front, like in a traditional vocal way.
Waking Season, Phil kind of started to, there's vocoder vocals that kind of pushed the envelope in that direction.
What you mean, like in
stick
terms
a toe
of
in.
Intelligible, upfront, unaffected?
Yeah. I just wrote a song that encompassed where we were all at, I think. And then it just kind of pieced itself together.
Was there any pushback? Was there any like hard line, like, no way, man?
From the rest of the band?
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Nope.
No way. I mean, with this kind of music, we're trying to articulate how we feel. And we've always felt like we've been able to do that instrumentally. But with that record especially, which was, you know, informed almost exclusively by grief, there's a limit there of what you can articulate musically. It hits a wall, and that's what lyrics are for. I mean, that's what words are for.
And on Circles, you have a tune with Kyle from Pianos Become the Teeth.
Yeah.
Of all the bands that you have relationships with, all the vocalists who are probably champing at the bit to get the Caspian feature, How did it end up with in Kyle's hands? Or his pipes, I guess I should say.
Well, I mean, his band does a lot of work with Will. Pianos has done, what, 2 records with Will?
Yep.
The last two? You know, we're huge fans of the band. Oh, love yeah. Kyle's voice. Knew that we wanted a vocalist on it. He just immediately came to mind. And we weren't even there when he cut what he did for it. It was just Will. And he nailed it. Now and then.
I remember getting that first take from him and just knowing right away. I was like, that's the ticket right there. And it's perfect. The song was really meant to have his vocals on it. Couldn't have been an easier transition.
Kind of crazy. Kyle sent me the original demo and he's like, oh, it sounds kind of weird. Like I'm just singing into my MacBook.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it does sound pretty bad, but we all listened to it and we're like, okay, this is going to be sick. So
did he write the words and the vocal melodies and all that stuff?
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
you gave him full birth to do whatever?
He asked for the lyrics to the final song, the title track.
Okay.
He wanted to use that as sort of like a bit of bearing.
The prompt, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Pianos does a similar thing where they have these kind of encompassing records that there's a theme throughout the entire thing.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
I'm sure he just, that's more into his comfort zone, didn't have some sort of bearing or idea of what the record is.
Pretty sure Will had a lot to do with some of the vocal melodies too.
And he did background vocals too.
Yeah,
Will did. Yeah, guy's got his mitts all over this thing.
What's crazy is that Will is also an insane drummer. That might be what he's actually best at, playing drums. He used to play with Lauryn Hill.
No shit.
Yeah,
you've heard of her.
Have you heard of Lauryn
Hill? Once or twice. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, he's got the Lauryn Hill microphone at Studio 4, like that he tracked.
We
singing.
Played a $2 toy through it to get one of the. Played a $2 toy through a $12,000 microphone.
Now that you've kind of incorporated more lyrics, has there been any temptation to revisit old material and see, like, oh, maybe this would be, this song could use something here or there? Or is it all kind of set in stone, like move ahead?
I don't think we've ever really thought about it.
Never once. Okay, but it's certainly not a bad idea. I don't think we've never thought of it because we think it's a poor idea. It's just when a song is done, when a record is done, that's it. We move on to the next thing. We kind of have this sweet spot.
It's a Polaroid. It is what it is. It stays what it is. It's kind of nostalgic. And
do people know what Polaroids are anymore?
I don't know the answer to that either.
Moving on. You mentioned that some of these songs are informed by specific things like grief. Are any of the songs on Circles about something? Is there that much intent to the meaning or the subject?
Well, Ishmael is certainly Aaron's homage to his Appalachian Trail
trip. That tracks with
I mean, none of us were there with him, but every time I listen to that song, I feel like I'm there. Musically, it has that ability to be really transportive to what I feel as like a real specific place.
It's got loons in the in the opening track.
The loons, and there's also this really plodding rhythm. Kind of feel like you're like walking a little bit.
Yeah,
you just picture Aaron walking down the trail with his little ukulele thing on his back, just like swinging around
for hours.
Is that accurate? Yeah, that seems accurate.
Were you hiking the trail alone?
I did it with my wife, actually.
That's good.
Yeah,
you gotta have company for something like
that. It's good to have a friend.
How long did it take you?
6 months, 7 months.
Oh my god!
6 months of hiking, month of just hanging.
I'm very jealous.
It was the best thing I ever did.
These guys are all here. They can all hear you,
It's okay. They know.
You talked about earlier records having a broader concept to them. How often do you find people are, picking up what you're putting down? Like, how easy is it for you to convey effectively what you're putting into it? Or does it matter if people get something different out of it to you guys?
Yeah, we want people to have their own trip to it. So we would never explicitly say what we're going for thematically, emotionally with the record. Sometimes, like in the case of our last album, everyone kind of knew where we were at in terms of what had befallen there. But for the other ones, part of the thrill of this is walking that fine line between being descriptive of what we're going for and then leaving what remains to the imagination.
A little cryptic.
I don't know. Try and encourage people to sort of be detectives when they listen to the record. And if there's a texture that surfaces here and there, like, does that have a meaning? Does it not? The mood flow of the collection of songs, like, that's all very intentional. But we would never come out and explicitly tell anyone what that is. I think that kind of takes some of the fun out of it. And it saps people of that inherent creative ability, which is what we love about music. And when music's at the height of its powers, I feel like it's encouraging people to be creative, whether that's trying to find the theme of a record or contributing to something that they make creatively, whether it's their own music or their own art or whatever it may be. That's when it's at its height.
I think conceptually too, like, we aren't always aligned on like what the themes are. We don't discuss them, you know, like, we can sometimes articulate that we get some of the same things out of them, but it's like a personal experience too, and you're supposed to figure it out for yourself, and that's kind of half the fun, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, experience. When I was listening through your earlier stuff, I was listening on a digital streaming service, which I don't think that they've put any ad money into this, so I won't do them the kindness of mentioning which one. But
you can say Pandora, it's fine.
It took me a long time, but I listened to your whole thing through Pandora's channel. But do you think it's a different experience listening that way, something more passive versus sitting in front of your stereo with the record jacket or maybe looking at the liner notes or images that you've deliberately put with the album? Is there something lost? This is like a really big, broad meta question.
I mean, absolutely. It's funny because we put so much time into getting these insane tones and textures and sounds, and then someone's listening to it on their MacBook
or their phone.
So the last record, we did these listening parties where Phil and I went to a couple of random cities in Europe with these tiny iPod kind of things that were just nondescript things. You just like press play and the record starts, and people were able to go wherever they wanted in the chosen location and create their own first listening experience. And ideally, everyone would do that when they got the new record, but I know that's...
You want people to be more deliberate in the way that they enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, everyone has their own way of experiencing music. Phil has an amazing way of experiencing music. Actually, I guess it's kind of a North Shore thing.
Yeah. For me, it's between 2:30 and 4:30 in the morning, but it's bombing up and down Route 127 there between Marblehead and Rockport. There's a few specific parameters that have to be in play, such as the weather, the moon cycle. I mean, it's like, I'm far from like an astrologist or any bullshit like that. But that ritualistic element of it is certainly getting taken away, not to mention attention spans and stuff. So with that last listening party experience, we wanted to sort of recreate that for people and do it on our own terms and, you know, curate that experience for people who may never have had that before or who had it and then it sort of lost it. Like the streaming thing came along, it just swallowed that up whole.
Yeah.
I think it's also putting yourself in a scenario where you're like need to hear the whole thing at the same time. You know, like you're almost in a forced scenario of listening to the whole record.
Yeah, I like the idea of having like a setting in which you are best experiencing music. So if you have any prescriptions, now's the time to shout them out. 127 at 2:30 in the morning on a full moon.
Yeah, I mean, for this last record, I do that. And then I just walk through the woods under a full moon around 2 and 4 in the morning. I just did that 3 weeks ago for this one. And that's the last time I'll ever listen to the record, which is kind of wild. So now it's everyone else's now in terms of where I stand. So I don't know what everyone else's rituals are.
I always just walk. I think I'm even too distracted when I'm driving to really pay attention to a record. I'll just walk.
You got the sound of the engine to worry about too.
I just put on like really good headphones and
When I was living up in Vermont, I would just have like the Radiohead release day scheduled, and it would be a bike ride at midnight down on Lake Champlain and make sure that I have the day off the next day and have my
own.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
It's got to be done.
I got to start doing this stuff.
Yeah. I'm just a classic guy, like you said, just sit on the couch with the liner notes, just no distraction.
Record player?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Old school.
Yeah.
I wish I hadn't sold all my records in my record player.
Mine isn't anything special. I just, for some reason, always end up sitting alone in a room with no lights on.
Oh, that's
my
classic.
Headphones just
that's how I listen to this, actually. That's how I listen. The first time I listened to On Circles, that's how I listen to it.
Whenever we finish up a record, there's just always a moment after we get the final mixes where I find myself kind of doing that.
Cutting off one sense to kind of heighten the others.
Yeah, my wife usually walks in and is like, what are you doing?
And you're like, get out.
You just ruined it. I got to start over.
Why are you naked in this room by yourself with the lights out?
I said no distractions.
Wait, I didn't say I was naked.
The subtext is there. You've all performed all over the world, places that even bands of your ilk don't normally go to, like, you know, China, Turkey, Mexico, Ukraine, Russia, all countries that are weirdly on America's bad side right now.
That's not our fault.
Sure. Okay. What do you think it is that has, that gives you this kind of global appeal?
I don't know. A place like Asia, it's, you know, such a culturally emerging place that, I mean, they will welcome anyone that's willing to go over there and play and be enthusiastic and put on a show, to their credit. So it's wonderful that we sort of got there right when the drawbridge had just finally come down, because for so long it was up, and, you know, white boys with beards couldn't go over and headbang over there for, you know, quite a long time. You get turned back at the airport. So
how does something like that come about? How does, like, a China or a Russia or a Turkey?
There's a promoter who's, you know, tapped into what's going on with a specific genre. In our case, with the post-rock thing, there's always someone who's really eager. They're scouring YouTube and, you know, streaming stuff like everyone else. And they find a band that they dig, and then they just work collaboratively with the people that, you know, they have in the pocket to get the band over. And some countries, like they're the Norways and the Swedens out there, where they have a lot of government money. So they'll put together festivals and, you know, fly us over and be able to pay for the whole operation and put a little in our pocket, which is great.
That's yeah. The social democratic way.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool.
I do remember at that, like,
fists.
That first big festival in China.
Oh my goodness.
In the interview afterwards, I think we're about to head out, and you asked them, you're like, hey, I'm just curious, like, how'd you find out about us? And they're like, YouTube.
Cool. Yeah, they were sitting around, like, you know, probably not unlike a lot of people here, because people are people, but sitting around on a couch with their buddies, blazing a J and just, like, watching YouTube. And up comes one of our videos from some shitty club in Atlanta or whatever, and they like it, and then reach out, and next thing you know, you just put it in motion, and if it works, it works. And wow. We're lucky because it's worked out. So.
YouTube, the great equalizer.
It's true, man. Yeah, it disseminates things at an amazing clip. It's really, you think about the reach of that site, and it's truly incredible.
There's a lot of bad stuff on there, too.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have you gone down a rabbit hole on YouTube?
Like, twice daily.
I've been here for 4 hours. What happened?
Kind of getting away from the global thing, I think one of the defining things about Caspian, to me at least, is there's this palpable undercurrent of Americana and kind of like folk music. And there's a lot of acoustic textures that I find are really useful in kind of cutting against like genre tropes, but also grounding your music in like, oh, there's a human there playing these notes. It's not letting the gear do all the heavy lifting. You know what I mean? How does that influence come about? Like, what sparks that in you guys?
You kind of play to sometimes what you listen to a degree. Like, as much as loud guitars do it, sometimes quiet acoustic moments do it too. And it's about the space between notes. It's about space between instruments. And sometimes you just need more space, you know?
Texture.
Yeah.
It was less of a question, more of a comment. I just like it.
Yeah.
That's a compliment, so thanks. That's awesome.
It's huge. You touched on this, but what does the post-rock thing mean to you? Is that like a useful descriptor at this point anymore?
Oh, boy.
Oh, here we go.
Well, yeah. Of course. I mean, look, people have to compartmentalize this stuff somehow. It's human nature. So you can't, it's nobody likes to be defined singularly in one specific way. I think everyone in their own ways, whatever it is, whether it's musically, you name it. No one likes being singularly defined by anything. But genres of music are a thing. So are subgenres like post-rock. But like, yeah, I mean, it's a real thing. I think we've just kind of grown ambivalent about it over time. At first, I think it was actively trying to eschew that because you don't like to be labeled and whatever. Yeah. But I mean, that's silly.
Well, it's ultra post-rock to like not want to be in post-rock.
Oh, yeah.
That's true, too.
More real.
That's true, too. I mean, I know people who will, I mean, when I say post-rock, they're like, oh, like Slint, you know, like purists.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Like, post-rock has become synonymous with like pretty rock. And that's silly because, I mean, Slint is a seminal post-rock band and their music isn't pretty at all. But they were, you know, using instruments in really unorthodox ways. They were composing songs in really unorthodox ways. Just like Godspeed You Black Emperor. Yeah, like Talk Talk.
Or Tortoise. You know, like they sound nothing alike.
That, any of those exactly. Bands, that's what post-rock was, you know.
Same genre.
But now over time, it's just sort of slipped into this miasma of anything that's pretty and ethereal and sparkly and nice and friendly. And that's fine, but it's just, I think it's a really a narrow way of defining what was and still is a genre with a lot of inherent promise to it.
That was Philip Jamieson, Aaron Burke Moran, Justin Forrest, Yanni Zubkoffs, Johnny Ashburn, and Calvin Joss. They are Caspian. Their new album, On Circles, will be out January 24th, 2020 on Triple Crown Records, and they will be touring heavily to promote it. I've got pre-order links and tour dates in the episode notes for you. You may find everything else you wish to know at caspian.band. In the next episode of Talking in Circles, you'll get a little taste of what my usual podcast, Sellin' Out, is all about. For example, have Caspian's increased stature and presumably revenue affected their sound at all? They say, not really.
There's still something underneath the music animating it that is, man, I was on tour for 5 weeks and now I'm back behind the bar, or, you know, banging nails or whatever.
It's the same trope as how comedians stop getting funny when they stop taking the bus. They get out of touch with what it was that made them funny in the first place.
Subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever your favorite podcast player is so you don't miss out on subsequent episodes. While you're there, throw a nice 5-star rating my way and tell a friend who might dig the music. This episode was recorded at the studios of Pod 617 in Westwood, Mass, and produced and mixed by me, Mike Moschetto. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. When shadows remain, the shadow.